You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. As always, I request your donations to my project here, as everything has fallen off. People like me are needed more than ever. And for those who have donated, I thank you very much for what you've done for me. I really appreciate it. And you may think I'm going to talk about the obvious. Today is the 17th of June, 2020. The problem with the obvious is that nothing here is new. Everything in here has been predicted by me and many others. It's really the same script recycled over and over again. There's really very little to say. Nothing about the narrative makes sense. The violence is being controlled by others. I mean, you know, there are hundreds of our people who are dealing with this issue. And there's really no point in rehashing it all. Generally speaking, that's not what I do here. Anyway. But I want to talk about something that's not entirely unrelated. I want to talk about the dissolution of the family, but not like a normal person. I want to talk about the divorce and family law in the Soviet Union. One thing that's worth talking about is that the destruction of the family unit in the United States since the early 70s has followed an almost identical pattern to that in the Soviet Union. For the same reason. As I've said 1,000 times before, advanced capitalism and communism are almost identical ideologies at their foundations and at their, even in the details. Even in the distribution of wealth and power, maybe a different mechanism, but it's all based on the same thing. And one of the commonalities that they have is that the family is outmoded. That men and women are not just equal, they're identical. They're based on quantity, not quality. So that's just a small bit of what these ideologies have in common. It always struck me as strange that the Soviets would go after these, you know, really non-economic or even non-political units, right, like the family, the church, whatever, many of which were already working on socialist principles. But I've been through that issue many times. My book on the Soviet Union is about the idea that these didn't, you know, the working class had no standing in the Soviet life. It wasn't about them. The proletariat was a symbol, not a reality. But all revolutionary movements have at one point or another involve themselves in so-called free love. It's a stupid phrase because it's not free, because anyone who ruled by their passions isn't free, and it certainly isn't love. Because modern ideology has no room for love. It has no conception of it. The family has always been a bulwark against leftist ideology. It's an alternative source of loyalty. And when you're creating a totalitarian system, you know, the word total is in it. It has total control, total regimentation. Something also identical with capitalism and communism. It mediates all relationships of whatever type. The family is a challenge to the party. The family is a transmission belt of tradition. The family is a religious unit. Now, of course, in Russia, we're talking about the extended family. The nuclear family is a distortion. The nuclear family isn't self-sufficing. It's the extended family, or especially in the Balkans, the main economic unit. The Radruga, and you have that mentality still in parts of Russia. So Lenin and Trotsky confiscated the means of production and destroyed everything that wasn't party controlled. The notion of a free union kind of always made me laugh, because apparently these men don't know how women pick mates. Whenever you have pure, sexual freedom, it's only a small percentage of the men that will be chosen by the bulk of the women, especially the more attractive one. So it's going to be an oligarchy one way or the other. Especially in urban areas, the sexual revolution in Russia had been part of life for some time. Now they're saying that any restraint on sexual desire rooted in the family ethic has no real benefit. The strange thing is so-called free union or free love is pure market competition, which no one seemed to notice at the time. I mean, women don't pick their mates randomly. This is a form of capitalist competition, and those who win end up with harems or an army of providers. It's always been the same, whether it be in the U.S. or in the Soviet Union. The notion of, working in the home is slavery. Working almost as a slave in the factory is liberation. And of course, those children left behind, separated from their mothers as early as possible, which was part of policy, herded into preschools and daycare centers and then the school system to be raised by the state as the next generation of cogs in the socialist machine. Of course, party elites never had their children raised this way. Early Soviet policy saw the legalization of abortion, the ease of divorce and remarriage, and the making marriage a relative institution. Generally speaking, all throughout the European world, wives were often, but not always, materially dependent on their husbands, but husbands had a legal obligation to care and provide for wives and family. I've explained it at great length, the Victorian law, that a man had to provide. This wasn't an option for him. He had to provide for his family. And ignoring these responsibilities was punished harshly, both legally and socially. Now, in the Russian Empire, family life was at the local level and done at the religious level. The state had very little to do with the marriage and family. The laws were mostly canonical. What divorce came down to was to resolve issues like infidelity or abandonment. Of course, physical abuse was dealt with by the wife's family, and they could handle the problem with far greater efficiency than the state. And when that happens, it's not much of an issue. But this was done at the religious and canonical level. The state was not involved in any of this. But when you have a totalitarian system, the state has to be involved in everything, whether it be capitalist or communist. Everything, all relationships are quantitative, come under scientific or so-called scientific regulation, and therefore political regulation. So the 1918 Family Code was at the time the most revolutionary piece of legislation that was ever forced on people. And of course, Wendy Goldman was the so-called professor at Carnegie Mellon, wrote in her book Women, the State, and Revolution, which is just, an absurdity, but at least there's some good information in there. She calls it nothing less than the most progressive family legislation the world has ever seen. Of course, it was a total and complete disaster. Wherever it's tried, it's a total and complete disaster. As the church was driven underground, religious weddings really didn't have any validity. The state created, registry offices, for lack of a better phrase. You would simply go in and record the marriage. And just as easily, either partner couldn't get a divorce without telling the other one. The process of divorce was so simple that there's no loss in money or time. And under the 1918 code, dissolving a marriage would take about 15 minutes. Now, of course, that's just signing the papers. Anyone who actually says that has never been through a divorce. I don't care if it's then or now. The problem was, of course, that at no time in history has this ever been instituted. They had no idea how it would turn out. But even its relationship to Marxist ideology is tenuous. Primarily, it was to destroy the transmission belt of traditional knowledge. But even Marx, remember Marx's idea of late capitalism. Late capitalism is a revolutionary force. The notion of being conservative force is ridiculous. The market and especially later capitalism is a revolutionary force. It's destroying national boundaries. It's destroying the family. It's destroying really any institutions that it itself doesn't create. So the destruction of the family begins in 19th century capitalism with child labor, women working, even the Communist Manifesto. He says, labor is at a point now where you don't need constant, strong physical labor to do it. And if women and children can be brought into the workforce, that means that wages will go down. Frederick Engels developed a ridiculous speculative theory in the family, where essentially he posits that it slowly becomes more monogamous over time from kind of this Rousseauian free love, even amongst relatives. And then I guess as more genetic errors enter into the population, they have to separate, and then slowly they become more and more monogamous. It's 19th century science, and so, as is always the case, it is ignored. But the idea was to liberate women from marriage and cutting them off from tradition. They had been the guardians of tradition at the time. But there's no abstract freedom. There's no abstract anything. So if tradition isn't the information that the family is promoting, then it's got to be something else. And in this case, it's party and propaganda. Like today, it's media. But what does this really mean? Anytime you promote something like this, it just gives men the perfect excuse to abandon their families. It works both ways. Now, it didn't last long, but at this point in time, after the 1918 code was passed and this became well known, suddenly men, develop these midlife crises, and they would discover all of these commonalities they'd have with young women. Freedom brought them to this enlightenment. But again, in a purely sexual free market, only a relatively small percentage of men ever benefit, because those are the only ones who are getting any attention. Maybe half of the women, but maybe 10 or 15% of the men. So most men were incapable of taking advantage of this market. So it leads to mass alienation. We all know the phrase hypergamy, or the word hypergamy. Hypergamy comes into existence when the traditional family collapses, and traditional, especially the rural order, collapses. That means female sexuality is the prize to be gained. That is what empowers women. Not working in a factory. And that is, they're able to hold men in thrall. They do it then, they do it now. You could have your, you know, alpha boyfriends, and of course your beta servitors. They become almost sort of like a medieval lady. But by the end of that year, 1918, you have almost 10,000 couples in divorce just in Moscow. And just a few marriages, maybe 6,000 total. And this is before the Civil War had begun. This was a political weapon. It was designed to break down the resistance of the old society. But by 1927, you had 10 divorces per 1,000 people, which at the time was about 300% that of New York City in 2014. So under the Soviet code, you had far higher divorce rate in Moscow than you have today in New York City. So one Soviet couple divorced for every four that got married in 1927. Which is, you know, 50% more than in the U.S., 48 times the rate of England and Wales. But the result ultimately, of course, is never freedom, because that's ridiculous. There's no abstraction that could result. It's isolated men and dependent women. And now, outside of the family structure and all that that implies, they're more suggestible to and by the state. And as it turns out, as is always the case in this situation, women were hardly liberated. They were just more enthralled to dominant men. Although in this case for a different reason. Not to mention having to work in the factory and still having to take care of the house. So they gained nothing. As always. That was the case in 1918. That is the case in 2020. Now, unfettered sexuality is not normally a part of Marxism. It doesn't come up very much. Sometimes you see it in anarchism. Except, you know, Proudhon. Proudhon was actually a good guy, where the family was the central institution. But it didn't take long in the new regime in the USSR that registration of marriages simply just fell off. Having a registration office was just a transitional measure. Chairman of the Moscow court, 1926, Stelmakovich, he said the broad mass of the population don't regard registration of marriage as the basis of marital relations. De facto voluntary unions are becoming even more widespread. Now, the reason for this was that, and most people can figure out, with these easy divorce laws, they also instituted the first socialist alimony laws. Now, alimony existed in all countries at the time. But in the Soviet Union, because it was so radical, and the shift was so sharp, the court system was very quickly burdened. And without registering marriages, it's hard to tell who's who. And, you know, anyone can claim this, which is we'll get to in a minute. Anyone can claim and become what we call the alimony widow, which became a social crisis in the early part of the Soviet Union that no one talks about. Now, men began to realize that the alimony scheme shifted billions of rubles to women, and it gained their support in the cities. So in a way, dominant men saw this as an excuse for free sexuality. Well, women saw it as free money. But again, this hardly benefited everybody. But of course, you know, even now, getting alimony payments were difficult. It was far more difficult during the war. Whether it be, you know, the alimony cases, which, I mean, not broadly, the courts were jammed with this. Men found many different ways of avoiding payment. Not to mention the fact that the war led to a massive disruption of records and morals, such that confusion is all that remained. Of course, freedom was never the purpose. The point of all of this was to dissolve the monarchist order and to create the chaos that the party would then reform into its own image. These laws are the quicksilver, so to speak, the alchemical agent that breaks down what exists. So as always, the promises of the left were absolutely miserable failures. And as always, they refused to take any responsibility for it. So the Soviet census of 1926, just after Lenin's death, identified almost 600,000 divorced women. Maybe 10,000 were collecting alimony. Of course, as confusion reigned everywhere, the conditions under which these cases were decided was completely arbitrary, and no law was really followed. All the point really was to ingratiate the communist ideology to urban women, who are slowly becoming aware of their social power and the desire of many men to please them. Especially, you know, and from the male point of view, after, you know, a decade of war, civil war, the Red Terror, men were in short supply. Marriages were based entirely on economic concerns and status. This was the opposite of Marxism, and of course the party was well aware of it. Not only did it not do what its promoters said it would do, it did the exact opposite. And the victims in all of this, as always, are the children. The state, really no other institutions left, you know, in the 20s, would take over childcare, which was a complete disaster, as they knew it would be. Now, Marx himself said very little about this. Maybe you had a population, say a Russian population of let's say 10 million. You had maybe 100,000 children in these preschools, and they're mostly party members. Vera Lebedeva, who was the head of the Department for the Protection of Maternity and Infancy, early on, said this: "The weakness of the marital tie and divorce create masses of single women who carry the burden of childcare alone. Imagine yourself, such a woman, without support from your husband, with a child on your hands, laid off due to a reduction in staff and thrown out of the dormitory, with no possibility to continue supporting yourself." This, of course, didn't exist in the Tsarist era. It didn't exist in any traditional era. This is what the Soviets created. This is what revolutionaries do wherever they go. So the contrast between the, you know, make-believe socialist ideal, the free union, and the conditions of the time was, you know, guttered out in the spectacle of women selling themselves. It made a mockery of the idea that women were free, independent individuals who could enter a union on the basis of personal choice, since that status has never existed. But that sounds an awful lot like modern capitalism. But these people have the nerve to create the situation and then complain about it and then use the disaster that they created as a basis for further action. Nothing in Marxist ideology is based on personal choice. That's a liberal phrase. Marxism has no connection to them. Marxism only knows classes. This wasn't about socialist revolution. It was about the destruction of a society, making it then easier to remake and reform. And it was worse in the countryside. The concept of free unions meant that land inheritance, well, the Soviets, you know, the Soviets banned inheritance, which was another attack on the family, a very important attack on the family. But it would also mean, in any kind of alimony arrangement, you'd have to divide the plots. Several landholding plots, which several writers at the time spoke of, and the exiles did as well. Ultimately, the only thing you can do is cut through the red tape with bribery, one form or another. That means, as always, the oligarchs are the only ones who could really take advantage of this. And then when they collectivized farmland, it solved the problem. But the chaos that was created was so bad that collectivization wasn't resisted as it would have been otherwise. I mean, there was a constant state of civil war in Russia right up to the German invasion. You know, there was constant resistance to collectivization. But because of the chaos, the destruction of the family by this point, and children being raised with really without parents in huge numbers, it's easy to herd them into the collective farms in the 40s and 50s. And of course, the old commune was under attack and was banned by the Soviets. You know, in Great Britain at the time, or in the Victorian age, but before then, the law demanded that women be cared for by husbands on pain of a civil suit. Belfort Box goes into these cases over and over again. Well, as is always the case from the female point of view, it gave immense power to attractive and well-connected women who had armies of suitors. And it was a buyer's market for attractive men too. So women under this regime received money for not working from the alimony system, but then men were offering all they could for their attention. So the birth weight was already low. You had a crisis of the massive numbers of war, Red Terror casualties. So you had a demographic disaster looming. Russia needed more children, not fewer. At the end of the Tsarist era, before World War I, the birth rate in the Russian Empire was very high, something that was not lost on the British. So, you know, this was the basic structure of the free union, so-called free love system. It was a complete rejection of both freedom and love. So, in creating this utter chaos, the family was then redesigned, as I've said elsewhere, in the late 30s, because, of course, a system based on Soviet or American principles simply can't last. When the family falls apart, nothing functions. And no one believed anymore that the state would somehow assume the functions of the family. And even Goldman says this, you know, that concept was abandoned. And this was never the purpose. You know, people like Goldman are incompetent. The Leninist experiment had nothing to do with the state, only social disintegration. So they destroyed the institution. They destroyed relationships between men and women. They destroyed the family tie. And then when the chaos was overwhelming, they recreated it on their own terms. Now, some of you have heard of one of the architects of this insanity, Alexandra Kollontai. E. Michael Jones deals with her at some length in Libido Dominandi. We'll talk about her biography in a minute because biography is pretty important here. Here's what she says in her 1920 book, Communism in the Family. There's no escaping the fact the old type of family has had its day. The family is withering away, not because it's being forcibly destroyed by the state, but because the family is ceasing to be a necessity. The state doesn't need the family because the domestic economy is no longer profitable. The family distracts the worker from more useful and productive labor. Members of the family do not need the family either because the task of bringing up children which was formerly theirs is passing more and more into the hands of the collective. In place of the old relationship between men and women, a new one is developing, a union of affection and comradeship, two equal members of a communist society, both of them free, both independent, and both workers. No more domestic bondage. No more inequality within the family. No need for women to fear being left out without support and children to bring up. Women in communist society no longer depend on her husband, but on her work. It's not her husband, but in her capacity for work that she will find support. She need have no anxiety about her children. The worker state will assume responsibility for them. She says this in 1920, and within 10 years, every syllable here was proven to be false. Not just false, but ridiculous. But the argument in this important snippet is that family life was a distraction from the building of the state, the collective farm, and the factory. Working under Stalinist conditions was a liberation, according to her. More importantly, the state now had a new flood of cheap labor to exploit. With children then being raised by the state, having nothing but media and propaganda, facing them. Kollontai was eventually purged, and Stalin received a lot of support when he did it. Earlier, though, Trotsky made sure she became the People's Commissar for Welfare in 1917-1918. Now, Kollontai's biography should tell you a few things about this policy. She, of course, like all of these guys, came from a wealthy, urban, well-educated family. Almost all of the Bolshevik, socialist elites worldwide come from wealth. It shouldn't surprise you to learn that her mother dumped her father for a younger man after her husband became wealthy. She could, have a younger man and still have alimony. Alexandra was raised by a British nanny. Now, when she was young, Alexandra told her mother that she was going to marry a poor man and she was going to work as a teacher to keep the family together. And her mother laughed and said, "You work? You can't even make up your own bed to look neat and tidy. You never picked up a needle. You who go marching through the house like a princess and never help the servants in their work. You're just like your father, going around dreaming and leaving your books in every chair and table in the house." This is the woman now who's claiming to know something about family life. This is a woman who is incapable of any commitment, is now in charge of the most important area of social policy. But when she married this guy, suddenly she became interested in Marxist ideology. It was her way of justifying her separation from the family. It couldn't have meant anything else because she never worked a day in her life. She had no idea how the working class functioned, which is, by the way, a condition most Marxists, almost all Marxists, have. And unsurprisingly, she soon tired of her husband and took up with another poor man. But she was from a very wealthy family, and she loved the idea of dominating poorer men who she could fix. She began to eroticize her ideology, the same ideology that justified her love affairs. But the reality is, she had no education in philosophy or anything else, and understood nothing about Marx or politics in general. The only reason that she was put in positions of power by Trotsky was her wealth. She was an attractive woman, and she used that to start affairs with men in influential positions all over Europe. That's how she became a Marxist leader. So her life was a complete polar opposite of what she preached in public. Now, because of her wealth, she was able to marry a man in his 20s while she was almost 46. That's the infamous Pavel Dybenko, a military man court-martialed for cowardice many times. This guy ran from the Germans in 1918, and attaching himself to Kollontai was a way to whitewash his reputation through propaganda. The Germans advanced on Petrograd in February of 1918. He fled the battlefield, and with a few friends, he raided a liquor store and went on a drunken bender for a month. Soviet propaganda, though, painted him as a hero on the battlefield and faced the Germans in the defense of Petrograd. He was again put on trial for cowardice, but his new girlfriend had saved him. He was thrown out of the party, and because of that, he began writing letters accusing Lenin of corruption, hoarding gold, and cowardice, of all things. At the time, he and Kollontai were anarchists, having no love for Marx at the time. But Dybenko had one thing that they needed, and that was his ability to steal money. Early on, robbing banks internationally was one of the ways that the Bolsheviks raised cash, but it also proves that they had no real ideological focus. Trotsky found him again and offered him a leadership position, military position, in the invasion of Ukraine, because he had a Ukrainian name. But from the start, he disobeyed all orders and then led his men to take Crimea, now that Germany had been knocked out of the war. There he created a tyrannical state under his own name and essentially subsisted by robbing the population. So when the whites under Denikin took Crimea, the local population helped the whites in every way. But yet again, thanks to Kollontai, he survived court-martial after court-martial, having been arrested for the execution of troops for that reason. Still, with all of this, he kept his leadership positions under Trotsky. The man never fought in a single battle, but he was good at terrorizing prisoners and unarmed civilians. Essentially, he was a mafia leader that was useful in stealing money. He knew how to use his connections, bribing the right people. And his connections with Alexandria was, of course, very important. He was your typical Marxist revolutionary. He had no ideological desire whatsoever. His military rise is inexplicable, except for the money he could draw on from his girlfriend. So by 1920, this man was appointed commander of the Caucasian Cavalry Division, the Southern Front, horseback division Southern Front, the Cavalry Division. The problem was, of course, he knew nothing about cavalry warfare or even horsemanship. His forces were wiped out by the whites for this reason, and still wasn't punished, was granted more commands by Trotsky. Dybienko won medal after medal for battles he never fought in. He won the Soviet Medal of Honor, or the Order of the Combat Red Banner, in 1922. Two more after that in peacetime for his suppressing of peasant uprisings. He killed unarmed men and received medals. He was part of the crushing of the Kronstadt Rebellion. And because of that, he earned the trust of the Reds. He became a warlord, using his wife's money and his own ruthlessness to gather illiterate sailors around him and took down others. He functioned by shaking everyone down. He did this at the behest of Trotsky, and that's why he got away with it. But that's not enough. Dybienko, without an education, hired ghostwriters to write books that glorified all his field experience. They were written by Kollontai, who knew even less about military life, but at least she was literate. His education at the military academy was done by her, and his senior thesis was written by her. He was almost illiterate, but he was so incompetent that he tried to compensate for it by cruelty. He killed out of frustration, so he was given jobs where that was important. So both Trotsky and Stalin would assign him commands where their enemies would likely be killed from his stupidity. So they wanted someone gone, they would attach him to Dybienko, and he would probably be killed one way or the other. He lived like an oligarch. He stole from everyone around him. And during the revolution, Kollontai was skimming from German money coming into the Red Movement, and that money bought her a seat in the Supreme Soviet. And that was actually at the time when the romance between the two of them developed. Again, this is your typical Marxist revolutionary. Finally, Stalin had him arrested after Kollontai was purged, proving that she was the only reason that he was promoted. Now, but he was finally caught using party funds for various drinking parties. They tried to get him away from it, the action by putting him in charge of forestry somewhere, and the NKVD eventually tortured him to death. And at the time, of course, Westerners were, you know, celebrating this man as a great hero for peace and justice. So that gives you some indication to the mind of Alexandra Kollontai and her boyfriend. These are the people who made family policy. These are the people who made the revolution. But Kollontai's level of delusion is matched only by the feminists of today, who use the exact same arguments as she did. There is no distinction between the USSR in 1920 and the feminist screamer of today. They're saying the exact same thing. She writes this from the same book. Believe it or not, marriage will lose all the elements of material calculation which cripple family life. Marriage will be a union of two persons who love and trust each other. Such a union promises to the working men and women who understand themselves and the world around them the most complete happiness and the maximum satisfaction. Instead of the conjugal slavery of the past, communist society offers women and men a free union, which is strong, and the comradeship which inspired it. When the conditions of labor have been transformed, and the material security and the work of the working women has increased, and once marriage, such as the church used to perform it, the so-called indissoluble marriage, which is at the bottom merely a fraud, has given place to the free and honest union of men and women who are lovers and comrades, prostitution would disappear. Well, either that or prostitution was just called marriage. You take that, you know, maudlin nonsense and compare it to what her life was like and what kind of a person she was. But she was eventually purged. Of course, she was aware that this was all just an excuse for promiscuity. near his own, even Lenin repudiated her near his death. But she's someone who we need to know because she was in charge of this first massive social experiment in family life. She wrote in 1921, she wrote Theses on Communist Morality in the Sphere of Marital Relations. She wrote, "The communist economy does away with the family. In the period of the dictatorship of the proletariat, there's a transition to the single production plan and collective social consumption, and the family loses its significance as an economic unit. The external economic functions of the family disappear, and consumption ceases to be organized on an individual family basis. A network of social kitchens and canteens is established. The making, mending, washing of clothes, and other aspects of housework are integrated into the national economy. In the period of the dictatorship of the proletariat, the family economic unit should be recognized as being, from the point of view of the national economy, not only useless, but harmful. The family economic unit involves A, the uneconomic expenditure of products and fuel on the part of the domestic economies, and B, unproductive labor, especially by women in the home, and is therefore in conflict with the interests of the workers' republic in a single economic plan and the expedient use of the labor force, including women." When she says domestic economy, she's referring to the household. So, in other words, it's meaningless and destructive when a woman does it for her family at home, but when a government worker does it, the exact same thing, for the same reason, in someone's home, it's not destructive. This has nothing to do with Marxism whatsoever. Housework is housework, no matter who does it. So it's not only useless, but harmful. In the space of a year, and I quoted the one from 1920, she went from claiming that the family is inevitably disappearing to the family being actively destroyed by the state. She expressly denied that in the 1920 article. It's not that the state is somehow disappearing anyway, and revolutionaries always love the word inevitable because it means that they're just pushing something over a cliff, but the state has to forcibly take over familial responsibilities. She calls family labor unproductive, gives a glimpse really into what motivates her. And she knew nothing about housework or the raising of children anyway. Her entire world was using money and looks to gain advantage with various men. The instruction of the family doesn't lead to free people. It leads to state control and total regimentation. And she does speak in 1921, in that same book, of the massive opposition that she received from Russian women, especially over children. There was someone else, Anessa Armand, who ran the Donotil. This is the it's almost an abbreviation for the women's department in the Communist Party. And her biography is very similar to Kollontai. This can't be a coincidence. She's French. She's from a wealthy French family, and her father was a famous opera singer, and her mother was an actress. At the age of 15, they came to Russia to visit her aunt, and her aunt was a tutor in music and the French language to the Armand family, the family of textile industrialists, so to speak. So she married, of course, Alexander Armand, son of the merchant, a merchant of the First Guild, very wealthy, and then her sister married Alexander's brother, Nikolai Armand. So the family then entered into great wealth by marriage. Anessa lived with him for 9 years, had 4 children, and she taught at a school for peasant children that actually the Armand family was financing. And of course, as is could be predicted, in 1902, she left her husband for an 18-year-old. Of course, another member of the Armand family, Vladimir. That's when she suddenly became interested in social revolution. And actually, she came into Russia on the sealed train with Lenin. And more than one person claimed that she was Lenin's mistress. So these are the two women who were in charge of putting out family policy. These are heroines in feminist history. and certainly the most powerful feminists in probably in the history of the world, since they were able to recreate the legal structure of an entire empire in this respect. Both of them had no connection with work, family, children, or anything else. They both were wealthy. Inessa deliberately married into money. They both dumped their husbands when they felt like it. You know, and you know, for Inessa, you know, for an 18-year-old brother, you know, she got tired of her husband. And both got involved in Marxism because of a romantic connection, not because they had any interest. Neither one had any education in this stuff. Both of them used their looks and their aggression to get the men that they wanted. And from that, they were able to gain power. None of this had anything to do with their abilities or their knowledge. They were actually fairly ignorant. Their theories were sophomoric. And of course, it all comes down to the fact that they were justifying their own promiscuity, which is something that happens when you, you're wealthy and you're good looking and you can afford, to take care of yourself. And to simply dumping husbands and abandoning kids, you know, suddenly they now put this as law in the Soviet Union. They're simply externalizing their own vices. But there were some newspapers. I mean, the Salt Lake Tribune, 1927, actually made fun of the Soviet marriage law. And the headline is, "New Soviet marriage laws find favor among women." And here's how they describe what, you know, the disaster that I described above. It wasn't just divorce that grew, but so did venereal disease and child abandonment. Frenzied feminists find the Soviet marriage situation much to their liking. It's the male of the species that the new marriage laws attack. Once upon a time, it was the woman who cried that she was deserted. Now the case is reversed. The dictatorship of the eternal woman has been declared, and it's the man who weeps. He weeps because now a law has been passed in the Ukraine, permitting him to be married without knowing about it. He can simply be notified through the post that a certain lady says he's married him. That's enough. No other ceremony is necessary. The lady announces the marriage, and he is now a Benedict, whether he wishes it or not. I'm not sure what a Benedict is, but I'm sure it's bad. But the point is he's correct. You could be married just by a visit to the registrar's office, sign a paper, and that's it, whether you're there or not. The law provides that either party can summarily deal with the other. But of course, it's the man who usually finds himself married without knowing it. So then, if he refuses, he then can be made to pay alimony, especially if there's children. The man is responsible in Soviet law after 1918 for all matrimonial work. Doesn't matter whether it's de facto or registered. He has to pay alimony to any woman who he could prove at any one time they lived in a state of de facto matrimony. That could be only a few days. That was income redistribution, all right. But cases that have come to court, in the Soviet Union at the time, shows this is true. There's always some woman to swear that the defenseless man was recognized as a husband of a girlfriend. The third person is a witness. A couple has a joint household. They live together for a week or something like that. And if there's children, there's no question about it. The woman will then collect from the man. But the new legislation certainly had men worried about going into casual relationships, because the Reds were saying at the time that de facto marriage is equally binding as a registered one. And if men were monogamous at the time, this is the reason why. So he has to divide his property with everyone who claims it. So then he'll make sure that there's only one claim on him at any given moment. That was, I mean, these guys who are writing in the newspaper are claiming this was the purpose of it. They'll enforce monogamy by allowing any woman who he lives with for even a short time to sue him for alimony. The last few years, of course, they mentioned this, that there's a new profession arising in the Soviet Union, that is the alimony widow. Now, the alimony widow is someone who gets involved in several short, what they call de facto marriages, non-registered, and has a brood of de facto children. Now, for the support, her offspring are legally entitled to collect a certain percentage of the wages of the man she names as a father. And she could do this to more than one man. She could rake in a much larger income than she would be able to make elsewhere. She can live comfortably. The Charleston Gazette in 1927, their foreign correspondent, then has the nerve of quoting the health commissar, Semashko, condemning the superficial attitude towards matrimonial relations which exists among modern Russian boys and girls, as if they didn't just create it. The legislation was creating, they were destroying marriage. That was the point of it. They see that their policies are destroying the country, and suddenly now, you know, they're condemning young people for being superficial. But he even goes so far as to claim that sublimation is a solution, channeling that sexual energy into labor. He says that these youngsters live more intensely than common sense should permit. And apparently he's published a book on the morals of young people in the Soviet Union. And the title, I guess, is sort of a parody. It's Rely on Alimony, but Learn to Provide for Yourself. They claim, of course, the idea of with alimony from one man, I could just manage, you know, I could live okay, but if I collect from two or three, I have a settled income for life. The Pittsburgh Press in 1927, in the USSR before Stalin, a couple could be married 1 minute and divorce the next. It doesn't cost anything. The divorce requires about 30 cents for the blank form and official stamp dissolving the union. They erroneously claim that a marriage requires the consent of both parties. That's not true, because you only need one. But it doesn't matter anyway, because divorce only requires one. So it's an extreme version of the no fault. This is part of the reason why there were so few marriages in the Soviet Union in the late 20s. They claim that many citizens have been married 7 or 8 times in a single year. But there were problems with it. You know, rich Russians saved from alimony fraud. Women get punishment for deceit. El Paso Herald, 1926, claiming that they're cracking down on the system they actually created. Alimony widows were brought into court for the fraudulent use of this statute, forcing a father to pay 1/3 of the salary for their support. And the court actually made reference to the fact that this is becoming a popular thing, and that strict steps are going to be taken to protect the right of the helpless male population. But the alimony widow became a social phenomenon there. Even Izvestia says these women are on the increase. It's become a kind of a sport or a business, a life entertainment, but as always, for the very attractive, well-connected woman. Certainly not for everybody. They knew what to do. It's probably very much an urban matter. So women who could have, you know, 5 or 6 children from different fathers, all the fathers have to pay the wife 1/3 of their wages for the support of the child. So, of course, the woman can live in luxury in that case. And 3 women who were sentenced simply were sentenced for being too greedy. And they started searching after, you know, wealthier and wealthier men. And eventually what's going to happen is, one of these men are going to be able to fight back effectively. And when groups of women were contracting with each other to do this en masse. And one of the women eventually broke and confessed. That's how so they were creating rings, alimony widow rings. And if a man, even a wealthy man, refused to pay, he was sent to jail immediately. And eventually, when in this case it was Vavrovsky, a fairly wealthy man who was sent to jail for refusing to pay alimony to these women, was sitting in jail. The woman had no money, and one of them eventually broke and went to the cops and told them what was going on. And they eventually served 2 years as a result. So what you had, this was family policy from the feminists in the Soviet Union from 1918 to the late 20s, maybe early 30s. Now, it's not that different from family policy in the United States today. It was abandoned. In other words, the social policy, the family law, that was rejected as being too radical for Trotsky is now the law of the land in the U.S. Now, the alimony widow in the age of computers, you could track these people easier. It's harder to do. But it does exist, and it's pretty much a regular thing. It didn't last. Of course, eventually it has to be crushed. And July 8th, 1944, the decree or the presidium of the Supreme Soviet began to change this. They even created the Medal of Motherhood for women having more children, strengthening the protection of motherhood and childhood. Then, of course, at least it prohibited the establishment of paternity in relation to children born out of wedlock. It made divorce much harder, and it made the marriage more firm. Legal significance finally was attached only to officially registered marriages for the first time in a while. If you cohabited but without formalizing from 1926 to 1944, you had to register it at some point. So the whole notion of the alimony widow was destroyed. The decision on divorce was made in the People's Court, and it turns out that even persons mutually wishing to terminate the relationship could be refused. You actually had to go through a process now. You can't sign a paper. They forced reconciliation measures, all this kind of thing. So it took really into the 30s, and then finally in 1944, the end of the war, that Soviet family policy was an absolute and complete disaster. Now this all changed. July 8th, 1944, domestic family law was completely rewritten. And the state, not the church, but the state then asserted its authority in family life. So the way that it went, of course, you had strictly a canonical, traditional and Christian influence on marriage. The state had nothing to do with it in the Tsarist era. Then its dissolution from 1918 to the 30s, the creation of utter chaos, and social destruction, an entire generation of children growing up with no family except the state itself, and then formalized finally in 1944 the rejection of all of this, and now the imposition of the state on marriage and family life without any opposition. The state couldn't have taken over in 1918. It needed to destroy the old first. And then, of course, this was changed again in 1969. This family code in 1969 confirmed that marriage registered with the registry is of legal value, but there was a way to terminate it. You needed the mutual consent of spouses who do not have minor children. And in the absence of dispute over property in court, the absence of consent to the divorce of one of the spouses. in the presence of minor children or dispute about the division of property. Upon divorce, the court provided for it, clarifying the reasons for it, taking measures to reconcile the spouse to save the family. So this, you know, developed over a long period of time. Neither policy has anything to do with Marxism, making divorce difficult. It's not any more Marxist than making it easy. Now, this is before genetic testing, so usually voluntary recognition is all they had at the time. That wasn't the case before. And, of course, you know, property gained during the marriage was what was divided, not whatever the woman wanted. This has nothing to do with feminism. It has nothing to do with individuals. It has to do with destroying an institution. And making sure, of course, that children were actually raised by somebody. The state never had a role in raising children prior to this, despite what Cullen Tye had said. This is the point. You know, Frederick Engels, he says, the communal care of children removes the anxiety about the consequences, which today forms the most essential social, moral, as well as economic factor that hinders a woman from giving herself completely to the man she loves. Will that not be cause enough for the gradual advent of more free and easy sexual relations, and with it also a more tolerant public opinion concerning virginal honor and woman's shame? So what it all comes down to is multimillionaire factory owners like Frederick Engels, typical Marxist revolutionary, who financed Karl Marx, had many, you know, secretaries, whatever. He was known for this. He never really got married. His money bought all of this. And he becomes a free love advocate because of it. He was able to buy it. This is hardly Marxism. The free love absurdity suggests that the oligarchy that creates it won't benefit by it. Now, of course, Karl Marx had a stable marriage, but Jenny is the best he can do. Look at him. It's a miracle she stayed. But for Frederick Engels to say that we're going to, you know, have the state take care of kids so that we can have more sex with young women, because we can't have those economic concerns hindering my sex life. It's what he says here. He puts it in abstract terms, but that's what he says. This is the basis of Soviet family policy. The point is, even with Stalin's reforms in 44 and before that, it didn't fix much. The family was destroyed. Children were being raised haphazardly. And therefore, the Soviet totalitarian state could function. This is one of the main reasons it could function. By destroying the family, by destroying even the concept of it, not just through the dissolution under Lenin, but then its state-controlled regulation under Stalin. Either way, the family is not real in this case. Only the regime is. Of course, I don't have to tell you that this is exactly what the system is now. You know, sexual revolution gives way to a regime where everything the man does in that realm could be considered harassment or something like that. It's the exact same process. You have to dissolve the old before the actual agenda can be put in place. The state couldn't have taken over marriage in 1918. And of course, the point of all this is that totalitarian governments can't function with a strong family. And this is what they have to do. Now, any situation we're talking about, whether it be the disgusting rioting going on now, the decline of the family, the destruction of the family, is at the center of it all. When that goes, and both capitalism and socialism are at war with it, when that goes, the only thing left is passion or power. But that passion and power doesn't just exist. It has to be channeled, manipulated, and governed. In this case, it's governed by the media. Just like back then, it was governed by the party. This is the foundation of totalitarianism, and capitalism and communism being almost the exact same thing in all of these important areas. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.